Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
First, to some big economic news today. The government reported that the U.S. economy grew at a pace of about 4% in the second quarter of this year. And that is big news when you consider that the rate contracted by more than 2% in the previous quarter. Joining us to talk about this is Marilyn Giewax. She's a senior business editor with NPR. Joins us from Washington. Marilyn, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, tell us more about what this report said.
It was good news. You know, I think it really just confirmed what we already knew in our hearts, which was that it was a lousy winter. You may recall that it was very cold, and that meant people didn't build houses. They stayed away from the shopping centers, and it really took the economy down. And economists couldn't quite tell, was it really a downturn or was it entirely the weather? Now we see what happened in spring. For the months of April, May, and June, the economy really bounced back up. 4%, that's pretty darn good.
Well, and it brings up the question, though, of whether it was pent-up demand that was just coming out now and we're getting what we would have gotten earlier on in the year, or whether it tells us something about what we're going to see in the rest of this year in the next two quarters.
Yes, as you look at it moving forward, it seems to put down a pretty good base for the economy to move forward. Over the past 12 months, if you put it all together and you look at four quarters at once, it comes out to in the ballpark of 2.5% growth. Now, that's a pretty good steady pace. It's not great, but it's not bad. It means that moving forward, most economists are now saying that probably 3%, maybe 3.5% or something like that for the rest of the year. So overall, 2014 should turn out to be a fairly decent year. And of course, there's part of your little heart that wants to say, yeah, we're robust, we're at 4% growth. But if you grow too quickly, that can cause problems too. Maybe some asset price bubbles, you know, maybe things get a little overheated. So this pace that we're on right now is a moderate and pretty healthy, and that's good for the Federal Reserve policymakers. They're meeting right now in Washington trying to decide what to do with interest rates. Are they too low? Are they too high? Is the economy too fast, too slow? This feels kind of Goldilocks-ish, not too hot, not too cold.
Well, and let's talk about that because it is a big week for economic news. We're going to get the jobs report from the Labor Department on Friday. This morning, the payroll processing company ADP said that private employers in this country added 218,000 jobs in the last month. And we're going to hear from the Federal Reserve this afternoon at 2 p.m. Eastern time. What might they do?
This is kind of a crazy week. You know, it doesn't happen that often that you have all these things come together, a GDP report, a Fed meeting, the jobs report. This is kind of a once-in-a-blue-moon kind of week for a lot of economic developments. And so everybody's watching to see what the Fed is thinking right now. But, I think the most likely thing to come out of today's news will be that the Fed will hold steady. I mean, that's what most economists are predicting. And that's to say that interest rates will slowly slope upward, but no big sudden changes. The Federal Reserve is, you know, it's the nation's central bank, and they have a lot of control over interest rates. And they have a lot of different kinds of tools to move those interest rates either up or down. And what they're trying to do right now, what they've been telegraphing all along, is that they're using some of their tools, this bond buying program. They're going to ratchet that back. They're tapering down on that. And then they'll start to slowly move next year, probably a year from now, towards pushing interest rates, actually starting to shove them higher. Now, that's what everybody's expecting. But, of course, they could deviate from that. Maybe they see something, you know, in these latest numbers that others aren't seeing. So everyone's really watching for that 2 o'clock announcement to see which way it'll head.
Well, and are the hawkish voices getting louder? Those people saying it's time for the Fed to change gears a little more quickly to maybe raise interest rates this year rather than next?
Right. There is a growing chorus out there. Some economists are saying, you know, these things, you don't just turn it on, you know, real quickly, and the battleship analogies and all that. You can't just turn fast. You need to slowly start to move. And they think the Fed's waited too long. they feel like interest rates should be moving up now because the economy really is, you know, if you've got 4% growth, you're adding more than 200,000 jobs every month, which we've been doing for 4 months now. So they're saying, hey, wait a minute, this is starting to pick up too much steam. You don't want houses to get too expensive, stocks to get too expensive. They want a steady, well-paced growth. And right now, there are critics who think that Fed Chair Janet Yellen is a little too laid back. But, you know, there are other people out there that say the exact opposite, that they feel like the economy is still too weak. And gosh, we need those lower interest rates. If you're a realtor, you certainly don't want to see 6% mortgages out there. So there's this debate. The hawks and the doves are fighting it out right now, and we'll know a little bit more about their sentiments when we get that announcement at 2 o'clock.
Eastern Time. We'll be waiting. NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax joining us from Washington. Marilyn, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, health officials in Gaza say 15 people were killed and more than 150 wounded by an Israeli airstrike in a crowded shopping area today. Earlier, Israeli tank shells slammed into a crowded UN school sheltering Gazans. A UN aid agency said there were deaths and injuries there as well. This war is between Gaza and Israel, but tensions are also rising in the West Bank. The West Bank is ruled by Fatah. Its political rival, Hamas, runs Gaza. And while many Palestinians in the West Bank have little sympathy for Hamas, they're uniting in their anger, thousands protesting against Israel's actions. The BBC's John Donison reports.
Palestinian grief, not in Gaza, but the West Bank. At dawn, at a cemetery in the village of Bit Umar, the family of Hashem Abu Maria wail by his graveside. Hashem was shot dead by the Israeli army last week as he demonstrated against Israel's actions in Gaza. 47 years old, a father of three, he worked for a children's charity. His wife, Samira, presses her tear-stained cheek to his tomb. She tells me he gave his life trying to protect children and that he'd been trying to stop youngsters getting too close to the soldiers. Samira is not alone in her mourning. In clashes with the Israeli army, more than 10 West Bank Palestinians have been killed and hundreds injured since the war in Gaza began. At one protest, well over 10,000 turned out. Mohammed Rabah was one of the organisers.
This is our message to our Gazan people, that we are with you and you are not alone. We are doing our best to show that.
Just about every night for the last 3 weeks or so, there have been clashes across the West Bank. This is the Kalandia checkpoint just outside Ramallah, and the street here is littered with rocks that have been thrown by Palestinian youth and the tear gas canisters fired by the Israeli army. But it's not just Israeli forces that Palestinians have been battling with.
This is the sound of Palestinians who are trying to demonstrate here, clashing with Palestinian security forces. The Western-backed Palestinian Authority, which runs part of the West Bank, is dominated by the Fatah faction. It has spent much of the last decade in conflict with its rivals, Hamas, in Gaza. The authority has an agreement to cooperate on security with Israel, and some have accused it of working too closely with Israel to crack down on Hamas. Mohamed Shtaya, a Fatah leader and an advisor to the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, denies that charge.
We are not helping the Israelis. The aggression on Hamas, on Gaza, is an aggression on all of us. We and Hamas are not at war. We're not enemies. We are political rivals.
His boss, President Mahmoud Abbas, has been largely silent, at least publicly during the conflict, focusing instead on diplomacy. But Shtaya rejects that the president has become something of a forgotten man of the conflict.
Let me tell you, he was in Turkey working hard with the Turks for a ceasefire. So he did all his best, but...
But for the people, the Palestinian people, for the they've not seen him.
No, they have seen him. He made two speeches, but Abu Mazen is not a kind of a person to make people live with slogans.
Others, though, say West Bank leaders have sometimes failed to capture the public mood. Youth activist Mohammed Rabah again.
The leadership should also listen to what the street demands, to what the Palestinian people demand. We want to use this hard moments to be united again, the leadership with the people, to be integrated.
The sounds and images coming out of Gaza seen on Palestinian television for the last 3 weeks are far more shocking and disturbing than the ones seen in the West. Palestinian politicians have often been divided, but on the war in Gaza, the Palestinian people are united in their anger.
The BBC's John Donison in the West Bank.
One more thing before we go to break. The last surviving crew member of the Enola Gay has died. Theodore Dutch Van Kirk was a navigator on the plane that dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. He died at a retirement home in Georgia on Monday at the age of 93. Van Kirk spoke on NPR in 2005 about that mission.
If you were in the 509th group and did not guess that you're going to be carrying an atomic bomb, you're pretty stupid. But if you talked about it, you're even more stupid. So I guess I knew way back about January, February, March, and around there that we were going to be carrying an atomic bomb that day.
In interviews, Van Kirk said that the crew wasn't even sure the 9,000-pound bomb, nicknamed Little Boy, would work. He spoke on NPR about the crew's reaction after they learned the bomb did work, killing 140,000 people.
When we got to talking about it and everything, one of the fellows, and I think it was Dick Nelson, who was our radio operator, and I think Dick said, "Fellas, this war is over." Hmm. Well, he was wrong about that. It took one more, but the war was over very shortly thereafter.
A second atomic bomb was dropped, as we know, on Nagasaki, killing 80,000 people. And 6 days later, the war was over. A funeral is scheduled for August 5th in Van Kirk's hometown of Northumberland, Pennsylvania. This week, a bipartisan bill was introduced in Congress that would legalize a certain compound in marijuana for medical purposes. It was introduced just a day after the New York Times editorial board came out in favor of full legalization of marijuana. So are national attitudes toward marijuana shifting in a significant way? Ryan Nurz is the chief cannabis correspondent for Fusion, where he hosts the Canna Business Report. He's with us from WLRN in Miami. Ryan, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Well, how significant was it that the New York Times editorial board got behind the legalization of marijuana?
It's a big deal. I mean, you know, it's the most noted newspaper in the country and one of the most in the world, saying that after 40 years prohibition on pot, that they believe that the federal government should allow the states to continue to do what they're doing right now, which is slowly move towards legalization and not bother them and come in and lock down these dispensaries.
Well, tell us about how attitudes have been shifting. You've been covering this for some time now. How are the national attitudes shifting on marijuana?
They're shifting suddenly very fast. You know, I started really focusing on this in around 2010. And at that point, you know, I think there was around 10 to 13 medical marijuana states. And then all of a sudden, every year, you know, there's all these initiatives in states. And every year it would be all of a sudden there's, you know, there's 12, 13, 15, 16, 17. And then obviously in 2012, when Colorado and Washington legalized recreational marijuana, that is a game changer because that sort of even put us ahead of countries like, you know, the Netherlands, which has been, you know, obviously it's sort of the paradigm for legalized or quasi-legalized marijuana. And now, you know, the perceptions have shifted. I think a big part of that is the baby boomers are sort of becoming the older generation. And obviously they have some familiarity with marijuana from the sort of hippie era of the late 60s and 70s. And all these medical marijuana patients who have real medical problems have sort of created something that older people and people who otherwise would have some sort of family values issue now see that it could have some legitimacy.
And yet there is pushback even among baby boomers. And we heard it on Meet the Press just over the weekend with David Brooks, who is at the New York Times, coming out and saying that that was not the right thing for the Times editorial board to do. Let's listen to what he said with some other guests on Meet the Press.
I disagree with them on the larger issue. I don't know what they've been smoking up there. They go up to the office, the haze is so thick, I can't see them up there.
They didn't inhale.
They didn't.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Maybe they did.
I have two basic issues. One, the effects on the teenage brain really are pretty significant. They acknowledge that in the editorial. And I don't think we can sanction, say, adults, fine, but if you're 18, You can't do it. That's just not going to work, I don't think. Second, I just don't think the government should be sanctioning activity that most of us mature out of, most of us age out of. I just don't think it's the way we want to spend our minds. But, and here's something I do agree with my colleagues on, I could be wrong.
So, Ryan Nurse, a lot to unpack there, but let's start with what we heard in the beginning of that, which was this making a joke out of it.
Right. Well, and that's the thing that, you know, I have, you know, sort of strived to do with covering marijuana is, you know, the pot jokes are always going to come. Oh, they didn't inhale. There's a ton of puns that come in. And him saying, what are they smoking? You know, there's always this ability to minimize it and to turn everyone into slacker stoners who are sort of laying out on their couch with Cheetos dust on their chest. And the fact is that, you know, that sort of slacker stoner cliche is morphing into something a lot more complex. You know, I know plenty of in New York City, producers and Wall Street bankers and attorneys who this is what they choose instead of a glass of wine or cognac at the end of the day. And I think that's just minimizing it in a way that's it's just sort of old-fashioned and out of date. And, you know, it just sort of takes the debate to a low-fiber level that I think is disappointing.
What about what he said about the effects on the teenage brain and the idea that this is something that many adults, as he said, mature out of?
Well, I think that's perfectly valid. I try to recover marijuana from a pretty balanced perspective. And the fact is that there's a very credible study, I think it comes out of New Zealand, that shows that relatively heavy teenage marijuana use in the years of brain development has led to a 6 to 8 point drop in IQ. And so one thing that you can say, and if there's any real Achilles heel of the sort of pro-pot movement, it's the kids. And the fact is that it's really not good for kids during the years that their brain is developing. And I think that's something that we should always keep in the debate. And it is a little scary because there's an element of Colorado, Washington, you know, turning this into something. Well, mom and dad, you know, I see these dispensaries. They look like Starbucks. And, you know, I just pass them on the way to school and it seems like everything's okay.
So given all of this and these concerns, and these are just some of them, there are other people who have other concerns about legalizing marijuana, how likely is it that more states will follow the example of Colorado and Washington State and legalize marijuana for recreational use? And how likely is it that the federal government will do something about it?
I think the first is very likely. As I said, from watching from 2010 this trend, it's just going up. And what happens is, you know, if you have politicians who are against marijuana on a sort of family values level and what it might do to the kids, once those tax dollars start to roll in, those moral issues tend to dissipate pretty quickly. And so I think that's what's been happening. And you see the amount of taxes that came in Colorado in the first month and the second month. And you're going to start to see those budget gaps tighten pretty quickly. And, you know, I think Republicans might start to lean a little more libertarian and say, you know, hey, government, hands off our guns, hands off our weed, and we'll take the proceeds. And also just because it's becoming more and more popular. But as for the federal government, I think that's the real final hurdle is rescheduling the drug from a Schedule I substance, which is, you know, basically means that it has absolutely no medicinal purposes and doesn't allow a lot of places that would otherwise study marijuana to study it. And I think that's going to take quite a bit longer, 6 to 8, maybe even 10 years.
Well, and there was a bill introduced in the House of Representatives this week that would amend the Controlled Substances Act, which criminalizes marijuana, to exempt plants with very low levels of THC. That's the chemical that gets people high. What would that bill do? And is that likely to pass?
I think that's much more likely to pass. And in fact, I'm down here in Florida in Miami, and they just enacted a CBD law. CBD is cannabidiol, is another cannabinoid in the plant like THC. THC is the psychoactive cannabinoid that gets you high. Cannabidiol doesn't get you high. So what it does is, especially for kids who have these sort of rare disorders with lots of seizures, the most popular one is Charlotte's Web. And this girl had 300 seizures per week. No prescription medicines were working. And this Charlotte's Web strain of weed dropped her from 300 to 3 seizures a week. So it's really changed her life. And I think, you know, what happens with that that's interesting is that, you know, you have a Republican congressman who's pushing that bill, and for good reasons, for those same sort of family value reasons. But what happens is that once the sort of Trojan horse is in the door, and if they do say, okay, well, we'll allow this kind of cannabis, then I think that it starts a really more vigorous debate about whether they can reschedule cannabis as a drug overall.
Ryan Nurz, chief cannabis correspondent for Fusion. He's also the author of the book Marijuana America, One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Relationship with Weed. Ryan Nurz, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy. Good to be here.
And let us know what you think. Are your attitudes toward marijuana changing? You can weigh in at hereandnow.org.
The one clinic in Mississippi where abortions are performed will be able to stay open, at least for now, because yesterday a federal appeals court blocked a state law. That law requires that abortion providers have admitting privileges at local hospitals. And all of the hospitals near this one clinic, the Jackson Women's Health Organization, refused to grant those privileges. Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhorter is here. And Cam, just to underscore, this appeals panel didn't overturn that state law. New clinics might have to abide by it. The panel just said the law could not apply to this one clinic.
Right. And it also said that in the likelihood of a trial, it's likely the law as it is applied to this clinic would be unconstitutional.
Right.
And it's echoing in a much larger debate, obviously, about this admitting privileges law, which is becoming a popular tactic among anti-abortion advocates.
Now, backers of the law were saying that women in the state could just go to other states. What did the court say about that? Was that part of the unconstitutionality?
Right. The court said you can't slough off constitutional obligations to other states nearby. It was a 2-1 decision. The dissenting judge said that it was, in fact, you can do that, and it's not an undue burden on a woman to drive out of the state of Mississippi.
Yeah. Well, this same appeals court upheld the same law in Texas, this idea that clinics, doctors had to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. Why was it upheld there?
Well, it's a slightly different law, but the issue, the court upheld the concept of regulation of abortion clinics and putting in regulations of various kinds on these various clinics, imposing various health requirements, and in this case, requiring doctors who perform abortions at the clinics to go get admitting privileges. They say that concept is okay, but here in Mississippi, there's only one clinic, mm-hmm. and the clinic demonstrated in court that it's likely it would have to shut down because nobody's going to give them the privileges and they're going to have to shut down. And mm-hmm. in Texas, about half of the clinics had to shut down. There was a similar law in Tennessee where a clinic shut down. So it's become a very effective way for anti-abortion activists to get clinics closed.
Well, as you write, far more effective in reducing access to abortions than the so-called personhood laws. These are the laws that attempt to define when life begins. Mississippi defeated a personhood amendment in 2011. But we're reading that on Monday, some clinics in Texas are going to be mounting a legal challenge to requirements in that state. There are requirements that some clinics meet building standards of ambulatory surgery centers. Now, sometimes that includes doctors having privileges at area hospitals, but it could have other requirements as well. So in Texas, clinics are going to be going at those requirements again. They're going to try.
Yeah, no, this is where the war is now being fought, the shift in the paradigm where you have opponents of abortion who are now shifting the argument to women's health, passing laws in state legislatures, whether it's meeting various building code standards, whether it's requiring admitting privileges at local area hospitals. Opponents of these laws, supporters of the clinics, argue that these are simply tactics to throw more bureaucratic red tape, to impose regulations that can't be achieved, and therefore just shut the clinics down. And the end result thus far has been to shut a lot of clinics down.
Except for this one in Mississippi.
Cameron, yes.
Yeah, Cameron McWhorter of the Wall Street Journal in Atlanta. Thank you.
Thank you.
This week, California put restrictions in place on outdoor water use in an attempt to deal with the drought. People can get fined up to $500 for wasting water. It's a sign of how bad things are getting in California, something farmers there already know. Bharat Bisabri is part owner of Shiraz Ranch in the San Joaquin Valley. And Bharat, how are your crops doing?
Well, our crops are making out for this season. We have done a lot of different things at the beginning of the season based on the projections of how much of water we were going to get. I had to sit down and decide what am I going to do with my crops, which ones I'm going to farm on which way. For example, in one ranch, I have about 500 acres, which are about 400-some acres of citrus. And I looked at these citrus and I said, I am not going to be able to farm all of these things. I don't have enough water to grow all the fruit on all of these acreage. Because citrus, especially the mandarins that we grow, you need a certain amount of water. And you can't say, I'm going to cut the water, let's say 30%, because if you cut the water, the fruit is going to be tiny fruit and the packers are not going to pack that and it's going to be all thrown away. So I had to decide which acreage is going to get water, which acreage is not going to get water. And to make long story short, I decided to take out about 85 acres of really well-producing citrus out of production. We cut the water to them. We didn't give them any water.
So you can't just buy more water if that's what you need.
I am doing that as well, but that was the first step that I took. The reason I took those acreage out, they were in their prime. They were producing good fruit and good production. But when I plugged into my Excel sheets the cost of my water, and it came out that I'm going to lose about $1,500 an acre if I farm them this year, even if I found the water.
So it makes more sense just to not farm them.
Exactly. So that was one of the things I did. The other thing is I have some pistachios, and pistachios, I can irrigate them the so-called deficit irrigation. So I'm giving them maybe 25 to 30% less water than normal. It is impacting my crop this year because the nut sizes are a little bit small. I have almonds. I'm doing the same thing, giving them less water, and I'm looking at them right now. The nuts are a little bit smaller than normal, and that is going to cut into my production in terms of the total pounds that I'm going to harvest.
Now, do you have to lay off staff because of this?
In my operation, I did not lay off any staff, but a lot of my neighbors that are on the row crops, many, many of them have laid off quite a few people. And actually, if you go to the west side of the San Joaquin Valley this year, unemployment is just really horrendous and very sad. People who were going to work on these melon fields, tomato fields, harvesting them, packing them, all of that stuff, they're out of job.
As you look forward, and you don't know when the rain is going to come and when the water will be more easy to access for you, how do you decide how much to conserve now and hold for the future and how much to just hope for the best and use your water now?
We had a communication from our water district on Friday that they are going to put into our account some additional water supplies that we had requested a few months earlier. Hadn't that water been allocated, I was going to run out of water on August 1.
Wow.
We are living on a daily basis. So I got enough water to get me going for August and September. We dug a few wells this year. They're not producing a whole lot of water. I'm hoping to bring into the system. And with them, I will have some water, hopefully, reserved for the wintertime because you never know. So beyond that, going into end of January, I'm not going to have a drop of water in my account. And a lot of public don't understand this. If we get a normal rain next year, our allocations is projected to be zero because there is so much of catching up to do. So many of the reservoirs are empty for other purposes like the wildlife, like the municipal, like the water that goes to Los Angeles Basin. We're not going to have water next year again.
That's Bharat Bisabri, a part owner and managing partner at Shiraz Ranch in the San Joaquin Valley in California. Bharat, best of luck to you. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, joining us now for some context on this is Lauren Sommer, science and environment reporter with KQED, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, and as you hear that story from Bharat, how common is that right now in California? Are all farmers facing this kind of trouble?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of farmers that are in a really, really tough position this year, but not all farmers are in the same boat. Certainly kind of along the west side of the Central Valley, where you do see a lot of almonds and tree crops, those farmers are really feeling it because they have what's called junior water rights. Now, this is kind of California's weird water rights system, but this is the case. If you got your water rights before 1914, so nice and early, you have senior water rights. If you got them after 1914, you have junior water rights. And what that means is there's a pecking order for who gets water first. So there are certainly some farmers in other parts of the Central Valley that are getting as much as they usually do in a normal year.
And what about people in the cities, like the city where you are, San Francisco, who are looking at this and saying, wait a minute, why should I feel bad for anybody working in agriculture in California? They get such a huge majority of the water that is used in California while I'm trying to take a shorter shower or not water my lawn.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we're kind of seeing that debate play out across the state, right? It really depends on your perspective. For a lot of these towns in the Central Valley where you really are seeing unemployment, seasonal workers that just don't have the jobs, that's something that does affect the entire state. Certainly in the grocery store, people are starting to get concerned about, you know, what they're going to see this year. But cities are in much better shape for the most part. You know, they're getting a lot of the water that's in the reservoirs. So certainly there's a lot of calls for conservation, but it's not nearly as drastic as what the farmers are facing.
And what about what Barat just said there, that in 2015, he's going to get 0% allocated to him?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the really tough gamble. What happened earlier this year is that state water officials did decide to hold some water in reservoirs kind of upstream to say, well, let's get a tiny insurance policy for next year. But that's not going to go anywhere near enough, far enough for people that are going to need water for crops next year. So, you know, you've probably heard a lot about El Nino. There's a lot of people that are really hoping that we're going to get a strong, wet El Nino, lots of rain this winter. But it's really looking pretty dicey right now. And El Nino in and of itself doesn't guarantee but it's going to rain a lot. It just depends on what kind of El Nino we get. And it's not looking very promising right now. So we really are facing some really tough trade-offs, certainly later this summer and this fall.
Well, I have to say, every time I open up my weather app, I look to Los Angeles and San Francisco and actually hope that I see rain in the forecast. And so far, you really don't.
Nope, it's been dry.
It is the summer, though. I guess there's always hope for the winter.
I know. Everyone's maybe doing rain dances around here and keeping their fingers crossed. You know, Australia faced a 9-10 year drought.
Wow.
And so it's not unprecedented that people really do face these types of extreme events that go on a lot of years. So people are really keeping their fingers crossed that this is a maybe 1-2 year event.
Lauren Summers, science and environment reporter with KQED, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
July ends tomorrow. When August closes out, how will the summer stack up? Will it be as momentous as, say, the summer of 1927? Charles Lindbergh crossing the Atlantic in May, kicking off a series of events that changed America and its place in the world. So says Bill Bryson in his book, One Summer, America 1927, which, lucky us, has recently been released in paperback. We spoke to Bill when it was first published and asked him to tick off some of the events that took place during this momentous summer of 1927.
Gosh, there were so many. Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs. Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic. They filmed The Jazz Singer, the first talking picture, which obviously transformed popular entertainment. It was the summer that they started carving Mount Rushmore. Calvin Coolidge astounded the world by announcing that he didn't want to run for re-election. There was a really juicy murder case called the Sashwaite murder case, which strangely just completely gripped the nation and much of the rest of the world. And it was just one thing after another. Venture of television. All of these things really, really did happen in one summer.
Well, let's go back to that Sashwaite murder, because it was one of the things I had absolutely no awareness of, and yet it led to two books which became movies, A Double Indemnity and The Postman Never Rings Twice, Always Rings Twice. Tell us about this case and how it captivated people.
If you've ever seen the film Double Indemnity, that's what it was. A woman, Ruth Snyder, who grew disenchanted with her poor, innocuous husband, and took out a double indemnity life insurance policy on him. And with her lover, a hapless man named Judd Gray, they decided to knock his head in with using a window sash weight as this poor man slept in bed.
Well, by the way, can I jump in? Mm-hmm. As happened many times as I was reading, I found myself saying, and what again is a window sash weight?
It's the weight that inside the window frame that pulls the window up and down. And, I mean, why they used a sash weight, I don't know. But it gave the case a kind of an exotic name for a start. But it was in every respect, I mean, both incompetent and really banal. They murdered this poor man, Albert Snyder, in his bed as he slept. And then they were so incompetent that they were arrested almost immediately, within hours, the case was solved.
And I shouldn't have chuckled as I did, because it's terrible. Somebody's murdered with a sash weight. But just give us a sense, because we tend to think this is the time when we are consumed with stories that spread on social media. But give us a sense of how it reverberated then.
Yeah, but what was interesting about it was very, very symptomatic of the age, because a new phenomenon had just come into American life, and that was the tabloid newspaper. And tabloid not just in the format, but also in the kind of attitude. You know, tabloids were based all around really two things, salacious things and gossip and celebrity news. Both of those were really new phenomena in the 20s. And the reason I started the book with that was not only the, chronologically the this murder really sort of kicked off the summer of 1927, but also those were themes that run throughout that summer, because with Charles Lindbergh and Babe Ruth in particular, the whole rise of celebrity culture was very, very significant. It had a big impact on both their lives. Lindbergh absolutely hated it. Babe Ruth, on the other hand, wholly embraced it, loved to be a celebrity.
Well, stay with Charles Lindbergh. Tell me something, and you do, that we don't know about Charles Lindbergh, because so much has been written.
The only thing that I've brought to it is that by compressing it down to one summer, by just looking at one summer, I am able to look in more detail just about the effect that this summer had on Lindbergh. And you have to bear in mind, this was a 25-year-old kid from Minnesota. He had no distinction at all. Nobody had ever heard of him. He flies into New York. I didn't realize at the time there were lots and lots of other teams of aviators that were all poised to make the flight from New York to Paris. But from out of the blue, there comes this kid proposes to fly alone without a navigator or a co-pilot, not even a radio in his plane, in a single-engine plane. Everybody thought he was out of his mind. He flies across the ocean, and of course, as we all know, he succeeded. But in the time that he left New York and landed in Paris, the whole world was just on the edge of its seat. It was just sort of delirious with anticipation. Would this kid make it or not? And when he landed, the joy and euphoria were so intense that the whole world really erupted in this moment of joy that was spread and shared all around the world. And I think that's a completely unique event.
Well, you also remind us about something that happened during Prohibition. We might think, what have we not heard about Prohibition? Well, I didn't know that at one point the U.S. government actually poisoned alcohol so that people wouldn't drink it.
It wasn't just that they poisoned alcohol so people wouldn't drink it. They poisoned alcohol so that, you know, if people did drink it, they wouldn't
they'd
do
die.
It again.
Yeah.
That was, I think, the single most astounding fact that I learned, you know, that the U.S. government was intentionally, willfully adulterating alcohol with very, very severe poison, strychnine and mercury, on purpose. So if it was diverted and turned into bootleg alcohol, it would, at the very least, maim and blind people, but very often kill them. And apparently very large numbers of people were killed.
Bill, how did you come to do this huge book? It switches topics every few pages. Each chapter has been books, you know, has been, you know, written up as a book by other authors. How did you come to this summer?
Yeah, well, there's a fair point that you sort of touch on there, which is that an awful lot of these things, Al Capone, Charles Lindbergh, Babe Ruth, an awful lot of the stuff that I touch on, I would guess probably at least three quarters of it, has all been written about before. But I also do really genuinely feel that by looking, by sort of freezing a moment, by going to just this one summer when all of this stuff was happening and when it was all interacting with each other and influencing each other in sort of ways that are not normally noticed, that you get a completely different perspective and you can actually see how this was a time when America was changing in a really fundamental way. If you just think about the kind of American attitude in World War One with the kind of American attitude in World War Two. In World War One, we were allies and participants, latecomers, but we participated. World War Two, we ran the show, you know. And the thing that happened in 1927 was that America was becoming the top nation on earth and knew it. And that was a real psychological difference between before that period and after that period. Within a decade of 1927, America was not just the most economically powerful nation on earth, but it knew it, and it expected to be the global leader in almost every area.
The summer sees the end of anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti. It may be the beginning of the Depression. I mean, just quite a time. But you also remind us at the end of the book that something so incredible as the flight of Lindbergh is so, we know about it, but if you go back to Roosevelt Field on Long Island, it's a shopping center with a little plaque.
Yes.
Where is the point at which he started?
According to the plaque, which you have to hunt around for, inside the shopping center, it's a nice, very handsome New York State Historical Society plaque, but it's underneath an escalator just outside the Disney store. That was the biggest disappointment, probably my whole adult life, really, because I went there and I knew it was a shopping center. I knew it wasn't going to be, you know, an airstrip and everything. But you stand there and there's absolutely no possibility, however good an imagination you have, there's no possibility of recreating in your mind's eye what had once been there.
Well, if you want to reimagine it in your mind's eye, you can by reading Bill Bryson's book, One Summer, America, 1927. Go back to that Long Island that once was. Bill Bryson, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Bill's book is now out in paperback. We spoke last October. You may have heard the latest viral video. 5-year-old Sadie from Phoenix sitting next to and gently kissing her grinning infant brother, heartbroken because her parents have just told her he will grow up.
I don't want him to grow up.
Do you want him to stay here little forever?
Yeah, he's so cute.
Because he's so cute and it makes you cry.
And I don't want to die when I'm 100.
Oh, Sadie, we don't want to die when we're 100 either. This video is producing giggles, but it broke my heart. So, Jeremy, we just want to give a shout out to Sadie. You just keep fighting the inevitable, Sadie. Tilt at those windmills and then maybe take a nap.
Oh, you are so cute. I love your cute little smile.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. Do you think that love will stay when they're older?
Oh, yeah, probably
I bet it will. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.